Indian Ocean nation of Sri Lanka, the calm of Easter Sunday was blasted away by bomb explosions at three churches and three hotels. The death toll now exceeds 200, with perhaps twice that many wounded. Seven people are said to be in police custody for questioning. We get a report from VOA's Marcus Harton.
The first six blasts that began around 8:45 local time were coordinated and claimed most of the fatalities, while two smaller blasts took place several hours later. The capital, Colombo, where three major hotels and one church were targeted, bore the brunt of the mayhem. Christian groups have said they face increasing intimidation from hardline Buddhist monks in recent years. However, such harassment is on a relatively minor level, says Jahan Pereira, who heads the National Peace Council in Colombo.
Who target Catholics? There have been anti-Christian sentiment, but it's on a very small scale with regard to these little conversions that are happening in different localities, but not to the extent where people were being killed.
Condemnation of the deadly bombings came in from leaders across the world, including U.S. President Donald Trump.
The Sri Lankan government has imposed a curfew and says it's blocked access to major social media and messaging apps to prevent the spread of misinformation. World leaders have been quick to condemn the bloodletting, calling it a horrific terrorist attack. Prime Minister Imran Khan of Pakistan said, "My profound condolences go to our Sri Lankan brethren. Pakistan stands in complete solidarity with Sri Lanka in their hour of grief." This day's carnage is sure to bring back memories of a three-decade-long civil war between Sri Lanka's ruling Sinhalese Buddhist majority and Tamil separatists based mainly in the north and east of the country. Those were years filled with atrocities by both sides. This is VOA News. Since the release of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report, U.S. President Donald Trump has celebrated the fact that he was absolved of collusion with Russia during his run for the White House. Trump critics, however, make just as much of the fact Mueller, when discussing obstruction of justice, never mentioned the word exoneration. Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway on ABC's This Week basically asked, who cares?
The word exoneration was unnecessary in the Mueller report, and I would say inappropriate.
Meanwhile, House Democrats insist they be given the full unredacted Mueller report, something the Justice Department has so far refused to do. And House Judiciary Committee Chairman Elijah Cummings on CBS's Face the Nation also talked impeachment.
I have to make decisions based upon the fact that it is our watch. And, you know, history, I think, even if we did not win, possibly, if there were not impeachment, I think history would smile upon us for standing up for the Constitution.
Once again in Paris, a Sunday morning cleanup. That's because thousands of yellow vest protesters set fires on a march through the city a day earlier, as they sought to drive home a message to a government they say is ignoring the poor. Police reported making more than 120 arrests. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has a report.
Tear gas hung in the air throughout the afternoon Saturday around the Place de la République in Paris. Radical protesters hurled paving stones and flares, attacked at least one boarded-up shop, and set fire to a few vehicles. Police repeatedly charged in an effort to contain the crowd. Associated Press reporters saw at least two journalists injured in the melee. Meanwhile, a separate, smaller crowd of yellow vests marched peacefully toward the cordoned-off neighborhood around Notre Dame. They're urging the French government not to forget the poor, even as it gathers millions to rebuild the fire-damaged cathedral. I'm Ben Thomas.
The U.S. has begun a multi-million-dollar cleanup of a one-time American airbase in Vietnam, which was used to store the highly toxic chemical Agent Orange. The launch of the operation outside Bien Hoa comes more than 40 years after the end of the war. Armed rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo attacked an Ebola treatment facility on Saturday near the city of Butembo. It happened just hours after another attack at the center killed a Cameroon epidemiologist. Police officials say one militia member was killed and four others were wounded in the second attack at Katwa Hospital, where medical staffers are trying to contain the Ebola outbreak in the eastern part of the DRC. On April 22nd, more than a billion people in 192 countries are expected to take part in a global day of political and civic action for the Earth. Gene Randall, VOA News.
and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, and thanks to my colleague Douglas Mpuga, who held the fort while I was away on assignment.
Earlier in his message, the Pope said, "The resurrection of Christ is the principle of new life for every man and every woman. For true renewal always begins from the heart, from the conscience." Yet Easter, the Pope added, is also the beginning of the new world set free from the slavery of sin and death.
Christians around the world celebrate Easter.
The new government, almost we agreed, the new form of the government, which will be a civilian government, which will have a presidential or a council composed of 9 people, 3 of them from army, 1 from police, and 6 civilian.
Sudanese opposition Umma Party says it will be part of a civilian transitional government.
The president has not committed himself to the implementation of key provisions in the pre-transitional period. Makes it very difficult for Dr. Riek Machar to return to Juba.
And South Sudanese President Salva Kiir calls on his former affairs vice president to return home. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Pope Francis expressed closeness to the Christian community struck by the attacks in Sri Lanka on Easter Day. In his Easter message, he also prayed for peace in Syria, Yemen, Libya, and South Sudan. Addressing tens of thousands of pilgrims gathered in St. Peter's Square from the central balcony of the Basilica, the Pope said the resurrection of Christ, he said, is the principle of new life for every man and woman. For VOA, Sabina Castelfranco has more.
Under grey skies, but in a St. Peter's Square filled with flowers, Pope Francis, dressed in white vestments, celebrated Easter Mass in front of tens of thousands of faithful and tourists. At the end of the Mass, the Pope gave his traditional message and blessing to the city and to the world. His last words before he wished everyone a happy Easter were for the people of Sri Lanka, struck, he said, by the serious attacks on Easter Day, which brought mourning and pain in some of the churches and other sites in the country. He said he learned the news with sadness and expressed closeness to the Christian community gathered in prayer. Earlier in his message, the Pope said, "The resurrection of Christ is the principle of new life for every man and every woman. For true renewal always begins from the heart, from the conscience." Yet Easter, the Pope added, is also the beginning of the new world set free from the slavery of sin and death. The Pope's first thoughts went to the people of Syria, victims of an ongoing conflict to which we risk becoming ever more resigned and even indifferent. He urged a new commitment for a political solution that will respond for the hopes for peace and confront the humanitarian crisis. The Pope's thoughts also turned to the people of Yemen, especially the children, exhausted by hunger and war, and to the situation in Libya.
Le armi cessino di insanguinare la Libia.
The Pope said, "May conflict and bloodshed cease in Libya, where defenseless people are once more dying in recent weeks and many families have been forced to abandon their homes." Pope Francis urged the parties involved to choose dialogue over force and to avoid reopening wounds left by a decade of conflicts and political instability. The Pope also prayed for peace in other parts of the African continent, which he said is still rife with social tensions, conflicts, and at times violent forms of extremism that leave in their wake insecurity, destruction, and death. He mentioned Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and Cameroon, but he also spoke of Sudan, which he said is presently experiencing a moment of political uncertainty.
Può aprirsi una nuova pagina della storia del paese nella quale tutte le componenti politiche.
Referring to the recent spiritual retreat held with South Sudanese leaders in the Vatican, the Pope expressed the hope for a new page open in the history of that country, in which all political, social and religious components actively commit themselves to the pursuit of the common good and the reconciliation of the nation. The Pope also mentioned the crisis in Venezuela and the situation in Nicaragua, where he expressed hope for a peaceful, negotiated solution.
Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
The Sudanese opposition Umar Party says it is in talks with other opposition and civil society groups to form a civilian-led transitional government. This after local media reports say there was dialogue between the military and protest leaders over a transfer of power to civilian rule. The reports say it is unclear if military leaders are willing to hand over power to a civilian-led government in spite of pressure from protesters and the international community. For more on the stance of the opposition party, I reached Dr. Mohamed Al Ansari, a leading member of the Umar Party.
Umar Party will be part of the new under reform, the new government, which it will be composed of declaration, signatories of declaration of freedom and change. Which are four groups, and Umar Party is a part of Sudan Corps, which will be represent on this government, and also unionist and professional groups and the alliance of Sudanese opposition groups. Under the new government, we have a different scenarios and different proposals which it might take place. Everything now under discussions and exchanging of views with our partners and colleagues in other political parties and alliances. So far, we come to almost we agreed the new form of the government, which will be a civilian government, which will have a presidential or a council composed of 9 people, 3 of them from army, 1 from police, and 2 from the army, and 6 civilian.
What makes the opposition Umar Party and other opponents of the new military transitional team believe that they could be forced out to hand over power to a civilian-led government, of which will be announced today? What gives you that confidence?
So the confidence it has been given to all Sudanese people by a million of Sudanese going to the streets, forcing the previous regime to move down. Yes, we managed to change Bashir, but unfortunately still we didn't. We are working to change the system. So Sudanese people, they have the main voice of the new era of the new Sudan. So accountability, social coherence and justice, this will be the slogan of the new era, which is taking now place in Sudan. Also like genocide and crime against humanity are started to be investigated, which also is a good sign the Sudanese people are going to the right path and the right route for a new Sudan.
Talking about investigation, we understand that some large sums of money have been found in the home of former President Omar Hassan al-Bashir. Some are calling for an independent investigation concerning these amount of monies found in his residence.
Yes, for about 30 years, standing very strong against corruption and money laundering and all forms of using public funds for personal circumstances. It's good news Sudan authorities arrested Bashir, a member of his party, and also National Security Service found huge amount of money in Bashir's house. So that it means Bashir is engaging very heavily in money laundering and positions of large sums of foreign currencies without legal grounds. They found around $351,000 and more than 6 million euros, which is a huge amount. If Bashir is a wise man, he can use that money to fund his government, to give him more stability and more ground of continuity. But unfortunately, most of member of previous regime are very corrupted. They're using the public money. They are creating huge amount of poverty and huge scale of poverty in Sudan. And that indicated of many Sudanese people, refugees camp or They are migrating from other countries or now living in foreign countries.
Dr. Mohamed Al Ansari is a leading member of the Sudanese opposition Umar Party. He spoke with me from London. Meanwhile, South Sudanese President Salva Kiir has called on his former affairs vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, leader of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition or SPLIO, to return home to help end the crisis. The president, however, cautioned that if the former affairs vice president fails to return home, hopes of resolving the ongoing crisis will be dashed. His remarks came after Machar says it will not be safe for him to return to the country, which remains in conflict. For additional reaction to the president's call, Eric Manasseh Zindo, the SPLM's IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth Empowerment and Sports.
My impression is that the call is not in good faith. If it was in good faith, at least we could have seen serious commitment from the president in the implementation of key provisions in the pre-transitional period. The fact that the president has not committed himself to the implementation of key provisions in the pre-transitional period makes it very difficult for Dr. Riek Machar to return to Juba.
What else do you want to see, apart from the president calling on him to return with a good gesture? Some see it as a genuine and a good gesture to bring the suffering of South Sudanese to an end. Why wouldn't he just take him on this offer to help resolve some of the issues that South Sudanese face? They've been suffering for all this while.
When we negotiated the peace agreement in Khartoum, and I am glad to hear the president saying that, you know, he negotiated the agreement in good faith. When we negotiated the agreement, the matrix were done by experts. And the experts had every reason to believe that key provisions like the security arrangement, especially the training of the unified force and their deployment, the issues of cantonment, the issue of the number of states, all these things the experts had planned that it could be implemented within the 8 months. Now the 8 months is coming to an end, and there's nothing tangible. There's nothing tangible to show that the government side is committed to the implementation. So what we are saying is we do not want to return to 2016 again. We do not want to go to Juba and fight. So let us put things right, and let people have faith that the peace will last forever.
The president called for resentment and hatred for each other to be pushed aside, to work together to better the lives of South Sudanese to end the crisis. Doesn't the Pope's recent meeting with them, where he kissed their feet, enough of a catalyst to ensure that these two leaders will work together effectively to resolve these problems and crisis, as some people put it, that South Sudanese face?
We are very grateful for the gesture by His Holiness the Pope and the other religious leaders who had organized the retreat in the Vatican. In fact, if you read the letter, the Easter message from Dr. Riek Machar, he appreciates very much the gesture by His Holiness. To build on what took place in Rome, what we expected from the president upon his return to Juba is to say that priority for the training of the unified force and their deployment, speed up the issue of the states. And then at least if this one could be done quickly, then we could now know that, you know, the gesture by His Holiness the Pope has been taken seriously by the head of state.
So what does the SPLM-IO want to see, or Dr. Riek Machar want to see, before deciding that indeed the administration in Juba is serious and wants to work with it in order to accomplish the task of resolving the conflict and the crisis?
Training of the unified force, and their deployment, establishment of the containment centers, resolving the number of states in the country. These are major issues that need to be resolved. If Dr. Riek Machar can see that, you know, this has been implemented, he will be able to return to Juba. Not only him, also the key leaders with him will be able to return, knowing that, you know, their security is guaranteed.
Manasseh Zindo is the SPLM-IO's chairperson of the National Committee for Culture, Youth, Empowerment and Sport. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. France is spearheading a new higher education plan aimed to make it a more attractive destination for foreign students, but also a more expensive one. The move to raise foreign tuition fees has sparked protest, especially when it comes to African students, who make up nearly half the country's foreign student body. For VOA, Lisa Bryan reports that some universities are also rebelling against the tuition hike.
In many ways, the University of Paris-Est-Créteil, or UPEC, is the face of today's France and of France's reputation abroad. Nearly 10% of its student body is international. So it's no surprise its administration has been closely tracking the government's new higher education plan. Dubbed Welcome to France, the strategy aims to boost foreign student numbers from about 300,000 to 500,000 by 2027. UPEC supports many aspects of the plan except one, a sharp tuition hike next academic year.
Une grande partie de notre public international vient de zones.
Laurent Thévenet is UPEC's vice president for international relations. He says a large part of its international student body comes from North and Sub-Saharan Africa. They can't afford a tuition increase.
No, no, no! À l'augmentation!
Even with the tuition increase, French fees are much lower than elsewhere in the West. But the move has still sparked demonstrations. And like a number of other French universities, UPEC has opted not to raise costs for foreign students. Even so, some like Nanto Bralibera, a graduate student from Madagascar, are worried. Bralibera said he was shocked to hear about the tuition hike, which would have amounted to about 15 times more than what he pays now. It's not part of the budget of students like himself when they left their countries. Katerina Vukovic from Serbia is also on a tight budget.
I definitely have the impression that the strategy, that part of the strategy of the French government, will not contribute to the attraction as they want.
Vukovic says she's happy about the quality of education here, but she says Serbian students like herself may not be able to afford to study in France if tuition costs are raised. France is the world's top non-Anglophone destination for foreign students and fourth overall. It's home to the iconic Sorbonne University and prestigious business schools. A big draw is also the country's inexpensive tuition. Still, France has been losing ground in recent years.
We are competitive. We are very competitive. The problem is we receive a lot of students, but maybe we don't receive them very well.
Olivier Rollo is a French journalist specializing in higher education.
When you come here from all over the world, you expect to live like in America, you see, in big universities, campus. In France, it's not very, very like that. So maybe the students are a bit disappointed.
The government plan aims to tackle some of the hurdles by simplifying student visas, offering better housing, and more French language classes. It also aims to expand France's educational presence in Africa. Experts say the country's higher education strategy serves larger goals by expanding French influence and interests abroad. Over the decades, presidents and business leaders, especially from France's former African colonies, earned university degrees here.
It's important to get the best students who will tomorrow will be in charge of their countries.
France may also profit from potential barriers to studying elsewhere, including tougher immigration restrictions in the United States and uncertainty over Brexit. The government plans to increase scholarships to offset tuition hikes for the neediest students. But in today's competitive environment, that may not be enough. A recent study by Campus France, which represents French education globally, found a sharp drop so far in African enrollment since the plan was announced.
It's not very a problem for Chinese students or Indian students or American students to pay more. It's a problem for African students to pay more.
Holo says the best and brightest students risk going elsewhere. Saudi Arabia and Turkey, for example, offer attractive scholarships. While aiming to attract more students from other parts of the world, UPEC wants to expand its presence in Africa as a way, UPEC's Tevene says, to contribute to the continent's development. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Crete, France.
A light to moderate turnout was reported on day one of a three-day constitutional referendum in which voters are expected to approve lengthening the president's term in office and strengthening his power over the judiciary and the government bureaucracy. Official results are expected in about a week. For VOA, Edward Uranian reports from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
A smiling President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi cast his ballot as polling began Saturday morning in a three-day referendum to make changes to Egypt's post-revolution constitution. Those changes will strengthen his hand over parts of the government and lengthen his term in office from 4 to 6 years. Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly told journalists at a central Cairo polling station that voters should turn out to voice their opinion. He says that he is casting his own ballot as an Egyptian citizen and urges everyone else to do so as well, to show a positive spirit in what he calls an important matter. 62 million Egyptians are registered to vote of an estimated population of around 100 million. A large number of people could be seen at several polling stations in the center of Cairo, while others in outlying parts of the capital in Giza appeared to have a light turnout. Gamal Nuruddin Zaki, governor of Asyut province, told journalists that things were going smoothly on the first day of the referendum, and he expected a fairly good turnout after all the ballots were tabulated at the end of day three. He says that he expects around half of all eligible voters in Asyut to cast their ballots, and he stresses that there have been no complaints about problems with voting so far. Abdulaziz al-Husseini, the deputy head of the opposition Tayar al-Karama party, told Al-Hora TV that he was not happy with the referendum since it was extremely difficult to oppose the proposed constitutional changes. He says that opponents of the changes are only able to express their opinion on social media and at press conferences, but that there is no possibility of putting up posters or engaging citizens at coffee shops and universities. Ahmed Al-Khamis, a member of the Institute of Administrative Studies, told Al-Hora that the most important issue in the referendum is to maintain stability in the country. He says that it is important to show the outside world that Egyptians are determined to protect their country, since we are living in an extremely unstable part of the world with many neighboring countries in turmoil. Egyptian opposition TV stations based in Turkey and Qatar, which support the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood group, denounced the referendum, calling it null and void. A government opponent, Ahmed Tantawi, said in a video on social media that the referendum cast a pall on the spirit of the Constitution and the revolution which gave birth to it. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. It's mainly a North African affair in the Confederation Cup, where three North African teams have clinched places in the semi-finals. Three-time winners, CS Sfaxien of Tunisia, were joined by Morocco's Renaissance Bakane and Zamalek of Egypt in the last four. The last place will be decided when Sudan's Al Hilal play Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel in the delayed quarter-final second-leg game. Political unrest in Sudan means the tie will be played on Monday, April 22nd, in Cairo. Etoile hold a 3-1 advantage from the first leg in Tunisia. CX Sfaxien beat Inkana FC of Zambia 2-0 last Sunday to qualify on a 3-2 aggregate win. Sfaxien will now face Renaissance Bekane in the semi-finals after they crushed hapless Gor Mahia of Kenya 5-1 in the second leg to complete a 7-1 overall triumph. Nine-time continental winner Zamalek moved closer to lifting an African trophy for the first time since 2003 when they aged Hassania Agadi of Morocco 1-0 in Suez. Zamalek will face the winner between Etoile du Sahel of Tunisia and Al Hilal of Sudan. The first legs of the semi-finals are set to be played on April 28th with return matches a week later. And this year's COSAFA Cup is back on again after the coastal city of Durban stepped in as emergency replacement for Zimbabwe. The 14-nation Southern African regional event was in danger of not being played after Zimbabwe could not secure government financial support. The South African Football Association has now stepped in to ensure the tournament will kick off on May 25th. It means South Africa will host the event for a fourth time in 5 years. This year's tournament has added importance because five of the teams set to take part can use it to prepare for June's Africa Cup of Nations finals in Egypt. Angola, Madagascar, Namibia, South Africa and Zimbabwe have all qualified for the continental showpiece. In athletics, a former Olympic 1500-meter champion, Asbel Kiprop, has received a four-year ban for doping. The Kenyan, a three-time world champion, tested positive for EPO in an out-of-competition test in November 2017. The 29-year-old had maintained his innocence and claimed his sample may have been tampered with. But an anti-doping panel said the case against the athlete is convincingly made out. The Athletics Integrity Unit, an independent body which manages all doping-related matters for athletics, also ruled his results and any winnings from November 2017 to February 2018 should go. Finally, in boxing, the fight between world heavyweight champion UK's Anthony Joshua with American Jarrell Miller has officially been called off after the American was refused the license due to a failed drug test. The voluntary anti-doping agency flagged up irregularities in the recent test on Miller, who has now been denied the license by the New York State Athletic Commission as a result. The decision leaves Joshua having to find a new opponent for his U.S. debut at Madison Square Garden on June 1st. Still in boxing, on Saturday, UK's Amir Khan's dream of becoming a two-weight world champion ended in controversy as American Terence Crawford's low blow was deemed a technical knockout by the referee in the sixth round. Crawford was leading 49-45, 50-44, 49-45 on the cards at the time of the stoppage. He now retains his WBO World Welterweight title. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Chagala wemba musanze
galine vana nyumirwa mbuze ke mirembe kali watenze mubita na yari na ye mikwano asana yo spesi simulunda simutaiza sibe manya kazanyo era uribambuza lwache mufanto muda monti katika richi mwechori Mwakabanga Kale wadolu mumbuza Na yebu asirika Sikaka ansa Esimu we imba Simu soya soya Zesiri loya Hera oni wambuza Luache mufancho Katika richi mwecho Karichi Karichi Oankewe mwagala mongeriewe mirembe Tapukani Katika richi mwecho Karichi Mundo kwa mwagala mongeriewe mirembe Tapukani
Nimi
changu na mini kupe chako. Kamu ni penny, hilo ni pako. We got a lot of issues to settle. Pamoja twende mseto. Love me baby, I will love you back. Scratch my back, I will scratch your back. Not this way, unapendo upendi. Unaniumiza sana, ninateseka. Nani moyoni mimi na uwa. I got to go, kanende. I let you go, sita weza.
Yeah.
tough must get going, especially when leaders become misleaders and mentors become tormentors. When freedom of expression becomes a target of suppression, opposition becomes our position.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Protests march is in two countries in North Africa. Algeria and in the Sudan have largely achieved their goals after weeks of protest march. In both countries, they have forced a change in the regime and have helped shape what has emerged as a ruling council. Nevertheless, the protest marches continue because there is an impasse as to what is the most appropriate means to achieve civilian rule in the long run. In Algeria, the military have chosen the constitutional route. They have followed the letter of the constitution, and they have appointed an interim leader, and they are proceeding on an election at the end of for 90 days. However, the protesters do not accept this schedule of the ministry. Likewise, in the Sudan, the protesters have not accepted the ruling council demand that they should continue for 2 years with some civilian participation, even civilian government under military rule, and also suggested that if the transition they have launched is properly achieved, they could reduce the time limit for the transition to less than 2 years. On the other hand, the protesters have come up with their own idea of a 4-year transition of the civilians, and the military has not accepted this. The problem with the protesters' solution is that to have a 4-year, even of 2-year transition would require electing civilians to run the government. Given the history of Africa, this has always been a problematic. In the case of Liberia in the 1980s, ECOWAS chose a very appropriate solution. The ECOWAS heads of state convened to deal with the issue. They selected a subcommittee of heads of state to police the transition and propose the assembly of groups in Liberia, civilians and other social groups, to determine what the transition should look like. That meeting met in Banjul. It was decided there would be a civilian transition of 2 years. And the novel solution was that the head of state in that solution would not contest the presidential election at the end of 2 years. This was agreed to, and that was what made it possible for a selected civilian government in Liberia for 2 years. It is possible that the African Union, which notified the Sudan a few days ago that it would lose its participation in the African Union unless it turns over the government to civilians, could intervene in like manner. Instead of just accepting the protesters' demand for their own selected 4-year transition period, the African Union can also convene a consultative conference in the Sudan, and they could also agree not on a 4-year transition period, but 2 years of civilian rule, but under the auspices of the African Union. That would also include military participation. This is a better procedure than just agreeing to select civilians to go under government, not knowing whether these will be the appropriate civilians. And what was true in Liberia was that during the transition, the civil servants were able to run the departments, and those from the ministries were technical people. So this seems to be an appropriate solution. In Algeria, it is difficult to see how solution could be found since the military is now following the constitutional routes. Hopefully, the African Union will now play a greater role in the Sudan to find a solution. I thank you.
That was One Mind's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Douglas Impuga, and our engineer for today, Xiao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, we mustn't confuse mastery with mimicry, knowledge with superstitious ignorance. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. It was a tragic